Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Hey, thanks for spending part of your day with me. There is so much TV to watch in so many places. We culture consumers are lucky to have someone like New Yorker's TV critic Emily Nussbaum on the case. In 2016, she won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism, so she's pretty good at it. Her most notable critiques, along with a few in-depth profiles of prominent television creators and two new essays, have been compiled into a book called I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution, and it is out today. Emily Nussbaum joins us in studio. Happy Pub Day. This is exciting.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So you've written so many columns, essays, profiles. We've all read them over the course of your career. What were your criteria for what would make it into this collection?
Well, I had a few criteria. One of them was I had to be able to read the piece without cringing and to actually still like it, which obviously for anyone who's written a lot of things is not true of every piece. But the main thing is that I wanted them to form a larger argument. I didn't want them to just be separate pieces. It's not a compilation of shows that I like or even shows that I dislike. It's really a bunch of essays that have linked themes and kind of trace my ideas as they change over time. It's a book about celebrating television as television and also about expanding what we consider worthy of serious critical attention.
It's also an examination of the art form from its beginnings to how it's had to evolve through streaming, how it's had to evolve through cultural shifts, through Me Too, through racial shifts. It's really interesting. You start with the definition of television. Like, what is this thing? What was this thing when it started? And you developed your own working definition of television. What is that?
The working definition of television, as I describe it in my theory, no, it's episodic is one of the main things that distinguishes TV from, say, movies and novels. It takes place over time. For a whole bunch of reasons, it's a more collaborative medium than most mediums. One person doesn't make it. It has to be made by many people at once. And I think that's a hard thing for people to talk about. And in addition, it has a looping engagement with the audience that makes TV change in response to the audience and the audience change in response to TV. People have very complicated relationships with shows that have taken place over the years. And a lot of what I discuss in the book is the messy dynamic of a show being simultaneously something that's finished and also in progress. It's sort of a rough draft being made in front of people, changing as it goes. It's an art form that is constantly changing it up and responsive.
What's an example of that symbiotic relationship you just described?
Well, one of the shows that I discuss is I have a big essay on The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. And part of what I talk about is the fact that people's worship of that show caused the creator of that show to become frustrated with how people just thought Tony was a sexy, fantastic, tough guy that they fantasized about being or having protect them. And partway through the show essentially became more punishing and colder. I think that made the show the ambitious art that it was. It changed up something that traditionally had been true of TV, which is that TV had to appeal to the broadest popular audience. It had to comfort people. It could never be alienating or boring or angry or strange. And part of what this book does is trace the last 20 years of TV and how it's come to break all of those rules. But in the case of The Sopranos, I actually think, in an unusual case, the showrunner's frustration with people's sort of sycophantic praise of somebody who was actually supposed to be a pretty ugly figure actually changed the show for the better.
My guest is Emily Nussbaum. The name of her new book is I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. By the way, she will be at the 92nd Street Y tonight with Wesley Morris of the New York Times, and he's hilarious and
he's
great.
Wonderful.
And that's going to be a good conversation. But I'm not letting you go. I still have my time here. So we're in this era of, it's been described as peak TV. I don't know if that's the way you would describe it. I'm interested, it's the quality, it's the scale, it's the volume. How has that changed your job, your work?
Tremendously. Although a couple of years ago when the phrase peak TV became a thing, I remember feeling, instead of overwhelmed, I felt an enormous sense of relief because up till that point, if you were a TV critic, you had to try to at least have watched all of the main shows. At a certain point, as I saw the chart that showed it just exponentially leaping up, it was clear that was impossible and it was going to be triage. And I think that's true for anybody who writes about television. But the thing is, TV has changed in other ways too. It's both expanded and contracted. It comes out of your phone. You can change what time you want to listen to it. It's streaming. Shows come out all at once. I mean, everything about the definition and the way that we experience TV has altered. So that part's thrilling, even if I feel overwhelmed, because I do feel like new shows continue to come out that challenge my own idea about what TV is and what I want to celebrate.
Do you have to shift your critique to include that perhaps this platform wasn't, or this wasn't correct for this particular kind of script? Does it give you, I guess, more to work with?
Well, it's complicated.
Sort of horizontally.
It's complicated because seriously, the last 3 years, just technologically, it's been a shock. Like every 6 months, there's a new way people get TV. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, it's just going to be chips in people's heads. And so, as somebody whose main thing is, I don't want to compare TV to books and novels, mm-hmm. To books and movies. I want to talk about TV as TV. What is it? Like, if it comes out all at once. So, I get challenged by that. But at the same time, I don't think I'm making a judgment of, like, which thing should be on which platform. I do question stuff like streaming shows sometimes seem to have oddly too many episodes. There's this weird satisfaction in a show that's exactly the right length. That seems to be a new issue because... Mm-hmm. On cable and streaming and network, there are different requirements for how long a show is.
We see A-plus actors, A-plus list actors like Meryl Streep on television, Amy Adams searching out roles on television. How has it changed the medium?
Well, it's kind of fascinating because just a few years ago, and this is going back to the beginning of House of Cards, Kevin Spacey at the time appearing on that show was seen as a very significant thing because a movie star was going to be on TV. And for decades, TV was something that people were ashamed of and mm-hmm. didn't treat as an art form, but it was also considered a status step down for any major star. And directors certainly didn't go on to TV. That's changed so much that people don't even notice sometimes when there are big movie stars who are now on television. I think there was a show somebody was talking about with, I don't think it's Julia Roberts, it was some other major star that I had never even heard of, and it used to be that it would be a big event. I mean, to me, this is as it should be. It always felt a little strange to me that there was this idea that if somebody took a fantastic role on a television show, they had to take a ding to their reputation. That's no longer true. But I think as big a deal as major TV stars coming onto TV, the equally big deal is directors flowing mm-hmm. onto TV. Mm-hmm. Because TV historically, for a bunch of economic and pragmatic reasons, was really a writer's medium, and often all the shows kind of look the same. Even great shows often looked similar. And at this point, you get a bunch of things financially in terms of the people making shows that can make shows look distinctive and, you know, the weasel word cinematic. And I think that's also altered the picture.
When you think about streaming services, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, aside from the obvious, which is volume and the ability to drop them all at once, how has it changed television?
How has
streaming like the art form of television?
Well, I have some nostalgia for the week by week model of TV. That's the truth. And writing this book really brought back all sorts of memories of even watching TV when it was not live, but it felt live because it used to be the sort of disposable thing that would pour into your living room. And then after a while, it turned into a text that you could revisit because it was on VCRs and DVDs. Streaming changed it in a different way because you'd get all of the episodes of a season at once. I think there are two things that changed. One of them is that TV creators couldn't switch things up in the middle of the season. They have to produce the whole thing at once. So the way the audience reacts or how they're responding to a certain relationship or the ratings they're getting don't change things within the season. The other thing is it changes the TV conversation because, again, part of what I've loved in television is the fact that week after week there was an ongoing conversation among TV fans, often online, mm-hmm. which was very formative for me. So streaming changes that because people watch the show at different points. But I would still say that even with streaming shows, for instance, Orange is the New Black, the new season's about to come out. I feel that that show has changed season to season in response to people's responses to the show and in response to politics, but just a season at a time, not an episode at a time.
My guest is Emily Nussbaum. The name of her new book is I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. One more online question, then we'll talk about some of the shows that you profile in the book. I'm curious about your thoughts about the internet and viral videos' impact on shows' health. Because I'm thinking specifically about Larry Wilmore. Had the show, which it took a little time to catch fire, got a lot better, and then was suddenly canceled by Comedy Central. And one of the reasons they gave was there wasn't enough viral content. There wasn't enough, you know, the way Jimmy Fallon or Seth Meyers, they have stuff that can go out and exist days after the program. What are your thoughts on that?
I have mixed feelings. I'm not a huge fan of the late night show format. I've often found it really stiff and rigid, and I get frustrated by the sameness of the hosts on those shows. So I sort of have problems with the rigidity of it. And the one thing that's changed is this tidbit element where they have to produce stuff that goes out and goes wild. Otherwise, the show's meaningless. I'm also not a big Jimmy Fallon fan, but I have to acknowledge that the one thing that show does very skillfully is to produce those little games and karaoke things. And people who don't watch the show have an enormous awareness of him. But that's kind of like a business element of the show and not really an artistic element. So I can't say that it's either a good or a bad thing, but it certainly is a kind of pressure on a creator. And it probably does take away from the ability of certain hosts to do deeper things that can't go viral. I have nothing against the internet, and I have nothing against mm-hmm. fun things knocking around, but it does seem to reduce the ability of shows to create stuff that's like a deep, long conversation in a sort of Dick Cavity kind of way. Because if your goal is always to create sort of one-joke things that can spread to millions of people, it's like producing little advertisements for your show inside your show.
My guest is Emily Nussbaum. Her new book is I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. Emily will be at the 92nd Street Y tonight with Wesley Morris. Let's get into some of your favorite shows. This is one I love as well. And I love that you love it personally and you love it as a critic, Jane the Virgin. You say Jane the Virgin, it was called Breaking the Box was the name of the piece. Why does Jane the Virgin break the box?
Well, I think the section's called Break the
Break
Box.
I'm sorry, yes.
It's okay. I actually don't remember what the Jane piece is called.
Oh, look it
it's,
up.
I'm really sorry. But the thing is, the whole book in certain ways exists because of Jane the Virgin. There was a colleague of mine.
It was called Love Actually.
Sorry. That section in the book, by the way, and Jane the Virgin definitely fits this, it's one of several essays in which I talk about shows that crack open and interrogate and examine and celebrate the structures of TV.
Let me give a couple of examples so people know. You have The Comeback, The Good Wife, The Leftovers, The Middle, and High Maintenance. Those are all under Breaking the Box.
And one of the things I love in TV is when a show both has a format and does meta things about the format and makes commentary on TV itself. And Jane the Virgin, for anybody who's watched it, is one of those shows that both is a telenovela, celebrates telenovelas, and comments on telenovelas. But not just telenovelas, because the show really is a beautiful celebration of all the overlapping categories, frankly, of the kind of art that is generally aimed at women. That's often about love, domesticity, and sex, that has bright colors. So soap operas, telenovelas, romantic comedies, and all of these kinds of things. But the show is very smart about commenting on how those things are put together. And Jane herself writes those things, and she's an artist who's struggling to create something that's both original and also sweet, appeals to the kinds of readers who like formulas, all those kinds of things. But when I wrote the book, when I was deciding to write the book, I ran into a colleague, a younger colleague, and I said, what shows do you like? And she said, oh, you know, just guilty pleasures like Jane the Virgin. And I basically went into this crazy speech. It's one of the smartest shows on television. It's beautiful and funny. It's humane. That doesn't make it dumb. Like, it's a lovely, lovely show. And so I partially wrote this book in order to celebrate the kinds of ambition that are present in shows like that, that I feel are less frequently recognized.
Can a show that is deeply traditional still be critically valuable?
Yes. I mean, to me. Mm-hmm. And if you mean by deeply traditional, maybe you mean network shows.
Yep, three camera sitcom. I mean, we just talked about those great shows that break the box.
Right.
Shows that are nice, in a nice box with a big bow that are traditional and sort of classic. Can they still be critically viable?
Yeah, part of my thing is every year I write a piece about how much I hate top 10 lists. And part of it is because I feel like it celebrates one kind of ambition versus another kind. It's not, I feel like you can both talk about these grand cinematic shows with all sorts of sweeping landscapes, and you can also talk about a network sitcom and the beautiful way in which it both uses its visual stuff and can say smart things about the world. Actually, there's this Canadian show, Kim's Convenience, that's a pretty classic family sitcom in a lot of ways. I've been watching with my kids. And there is something wonderful to me how in that context of something that's very familiarly the kinds of jokes that people find comforting, it can do these original things. It's about a Korean-Canadian family that owns a store in Toronto. And anybody looking at it would be like, this is a classical kind of TV, the family sitcom. And it still does so many different new and vibrant things. And also, frankly, it just expands the range of who gets shown on television, which has been an equally important phenomenon.
I'm interested, has watching television with your kids taught you anything? My 11-year-old has just discovered The Office.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Is obsessed with it. And it's been interesting to watch it with him and where he laughs at and the way he wants to watch it.
Yeah, it's great. I have two kids, 11 and 13, and we've worked our way through The Office, 30 Rock, Parks and Recreation. We're watching Kim's Convenience. We've watched, but Jane the Virgin is their big show, actually. But watching with them is fantastic because they have different senses of humor. They just find different things funny. I don't know. I like television as a shared experience. I mean, in this case, it's a family thing, and it's the way TV kind of used to be, which is a piece of furniture in the living room that everybody watched. People watch it, I think, a little more solo now. People watch on their phones, on their pads and stuff. But I still relish the way in which, like, TV takes place within a larger conversation, which right now is the internet. So I think all of those kinds of watching together really make TV good.
My guest is Emily Nussbaum. The name of her book is I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. You take on Me Too. You have to. I mean, it's such a huge part of the cultural conversation. This one specific, Confessions of a Human Shield, you write about, it's an essay about what to be made of these men who have made good television, good work, but obviously have behaved abhorrently. Why did you call it the human shield? Why did you describe yourself to be a human shield?
First of all, the reason I wrote the essay was quite specifically that I took my book leave during the fall of 2017. And that was right as the Weinstein piece dropped and all of the exposés came out, and it really felt like the world was being shaken up. And over the time I was writing the book, I was just subsumed in thoughts of this, and I felt like I had to write this essay. And it's a big essay, and it's attempting to do a kind of ambitious thing, which is both be a memoir and kind of think about that separating the artist from the art idea, that as a critic is really central. The reason I called it Confessions of a Human Shield was a lot of it is about my wrestling with my own relationship of these men's with these men's work and my love for certain kinds of bad boy strangeness and my feelings of guilt about that and my feelings of frustration. And it's really me walking it through. Like, if we're a finished essay, I feel like it's also a marker of a space and time in which, like a lot of women, I found myself thinking back on stuff from the past and seeing it in a different light. And so that's what the human shield part is about. It's about basically, like, what is my relationship to these men? Like, when I've written about their work, am I protecting them in some way?
You're right. I craved something else. Endless access, radical entitlement, the greedy ability to dig up to my elbows in any dirt pile, to chew on the rotten apple instead of spitting it out. I didn't want to erase the art made by these men. I wanted to scribble all over it in rage, confusion, and in pleasure, too, to make it mine instead of theirs. And my favorite line, where'd you do that, is when you describe Louis C.K., as a slob, the slob comic. In like one word, you just, it was a moment for me.
I mean, it's weird because it covers a lot of guys. It's like Woody Allen, who's a very formative influence on
Bill
me.
Bill Cosby,
Roman Polanski. And it sort of walks through these men and their art and my relationship with these men and their art. And it attempts to do what I'm describing in that passage, which is, rather than erase it and push it away because it makes me uncomfortable, but to kind of work my way through to some kind of deeper understanding that doesn't involve simply saying, oh, there's a person in the things they did, and then there's the art they created. It's trying to find a connected way to actually think about their work.
Before I let you go, there are essays in here. You have a great essay with Ryan Murphy. It's interesting because you write about hearing about the show called Pose, which is going to happen. It was really interesting. There's also Kenya Barris' profile. Give me the most creative person right now, you think, in TV? And then who's the most powerful?
That's interesting. Well, it's funny because when I read about Ryan, he was essentially ascending to this different state. It was like watching a Pokemon become somebody else because he was like got his Netflix deal. He's a pretty powerful guy. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who created Fleabag, does seem to me to be right now one of the most strikingly creative and powerful figures. I loved the second season of Fleabag, but the first season of Fleabag, I found when I watched it, when it came out, I was like, what? It's doing all of these new things with humor and persona and sex and all of this kind of stuff. So she's exciting to me, but I don't know. There are a lot of different creators. I just watched this show, Los Espookies, that's on HBO.
We've been talking about Los Espookies a lot around here.
It's just great. And the thing is, what I'm always looking for is this thing. I mean, it was created by Fred Armisen with, I'm blanking on the names, Anna Fabrega, and I think it's Julio Torres?
Yes, it is. Yes.
And anyway, it's this show that's half in Spanish and half in English with subtitles for them. And it's about this group of horror fans who do these made-up scenarios of horror. But anyway, it's just weird. And it's funny and surprising. And the main thing I'm looking for when I watch something is something that surprises me. Because I don't mind repetition. It's part of what TV is. But somebody who's cracking through to a new thing, that's always just exciting and welcome.
My guest has been New Yorker television critic Emily Nussbaum. The name of her new book is I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. Emily will be at the 92nd Street Y tonight with Wesley Morris from the New York Times. Emily, thanks for coming on down.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next, we'll be broadcasting our conversation with actors Annette Bening and Benjamin Walker, who are starring in the Roundabout Theaters Company's production of Arthur Miller's All My Sons, which runs just through June 30th. More after the break. Stay with us.